Hi, everyone. This is John Wesley Shipp, Barry Allen from the original Flash TV series, and Henry Allen from the current Flash series. And you're listening to Comic Book Central, where comic books come to life.
Hey there, all you comic book collectors, you superhero enthusiasts. All of you Flash fans out there, welcome to Comic Book Central. I am your host, Joe Stuber. Thank you once again for joining me here in the lair for another crazy cool conversation. The talented individual helps bring our favorite four-color adventures to life. This week, I'm joined by the original Scarlet Speedster, John Wesley Shipp. He portrayed the Flash in the 1990 TV series on CBS. He's now the Flash's dad, Henry Allen, on the current CW hit, Season 2 of which premieres in just a few days, Tuesday, October 6th on the CW. Spoiler alert, if you have not seen Season 1 of The Flash, and you're going to catch up on Blu-ray or DVD or Netflix, it's out there now, we are going to be talking about some key plot points today from Season 1 of The Flash, so you have been warned. Now, this isn't the first time John's appeared on Comic Book Central. If you're a new listener to the show, you might have missed Episode 93. That's the one where I moderated John's Q&A at Terrificon in Connecticut back in August. So if you haven't had a chance to check that episode out, you're going to want to do that right after you listen to today's show. Now, John's going to be along in just a few minutes, but before we get to today's interview, a few things to get to first. Huge thanks to each and every one of you for tuning into the show. Again, if you're a new listener, you don't want to miss a moment of Comic Book Central. The archive of shows, they are on the website, so go check it out, comicbookcentral.net. You can subscribe to the show on iTunes, Stitcher, Blueberry, they're on those services as well. Don't forget, you show your support by listening to the show, but you can help Comic Book Central Nation grow by sharing those episodes on Facebook and Twitter. Hashtag share the lair. Also, when you post a review on iTunes, that helps us reach a larger audience. With the podcast app, it's real easy. It's just a few clicks to do that. So if you can leave a review in iTunes, that really helps. If you like what you're hearing, take a few minutes and go do that. Facebook.com/Comic Book Central Network. That's where you can find us on Facebook. Just click share when I post the latest episode. That gets it out to your friends. Twitter, just retweet that bad boy. And your comic book loving friends, they can share in the fun that we're having here in the lair each and every week. Also, I have bonus Comic Book Central content out there for you. If you missed it, my entire Thor and More Terrificon Q&A with writer-artist Walt Simonson and artist Tom Rainey, that is online for fans of the God of Thunder. You're going to want to check that out. It's pretty cool stuff. Something else you're going to love, the Comic Book Central second anniversary special. That is right around the corner. Episode 100, it's going to drop November 7th. Email your favorite moment from year two of the show to me. You just might snag that incredibly awesome book, The Empire Strikes Back Notebook. It was first published in 1980. It's got the script. It's got the storyboards. It's an original collectible from The Empire Strikes Back, and it could be yours. Email those favorite year two moments to me. Anything from episode 51 on, email to joe@comicbookcentral.net. You can click the Signal Me tab on the website. I'll get it that way as well. Of those emails, I'm going to pick one. And that listener is going to get the book, The Empire Strikes Back Notebook. Easy peasy. Any of those moments you send to me, I'm also going to play them on episode 100 as well. So we're going to collect up a lot of those, talk about what we've talked about over the past year. It's going to be some fun stuff. So get those in now, folks. Also, it is October 2015. That means Back to the Future Day is almost upon us.
On Wednesday, October 21st, 2015.
2015? You mean we're in the future?
Throughout the month of October, I'm going to be celebrating the 30th anniversary of the greatest time-traveling tale of all time. Back to the Future co-creator, writer, producer, the man who thought a lot, Bob Gale, he's going to be joining me. Also, Mr. Strickland, James Tolkien. You'll hear my Cincinnati Comic Expo Q&A with him. Claudia Wells, she played Marty's girlfriend Jennifer. She's going to be in the lair. Harry Waters Jr., he played Marvin Berry, Mr. Earth Angel. I hung out with him at the Enchantment Under the Sea dance. He's going to be here. maybe another surprise Back to the Future guest. You never know. I'm working on a few things, but we'll see what happens there. It is my celebration of the 30th anniversary of Back to the Future. Tell your friends, tell your family. Great, Scott, get the word out on social media. You do not want to miss Comic Book Central throughout October. Speaking of time travel, my guest today, he is no stranger to that concept. Check this out, and I'm going to be right back in a flash with John Wesley Shipp. Born in Norfolk, Virginia, John Wesley Shipp first got the attention of audiences across the country in daytime dramas. He made some TV history in the process. For his role as Doug Cummings on As the World Turns, John took home the Emmy that year for Best Supporting Actor. The following year, John snagged the trophy yet again, this time for a different role, Martin Ellis, on a different show, Santa Barbara. In 1990, hot on the heels of Tim Burton's dark take on Batman, writer-producers Danny Bilson and Paul DeMeo, they were looking to launch another DC superhero into the live-action arena, The Flash. The show was for CBS, and when it came time to cast the lead role of Barry Allen, forensic scientist turned fastest man alive, it was impossible to look past John Wesley Shipp. He had the look of a superhero, and with back-to-back Emmys, he had the acting chops to tackle this incredibly grounded, serious, and unique take on the superhero genre. With fanboys Bilson and DeMeo at the helm, a stellar main cast, super guest stars like Mark Hamill, and comic book veteran Howard Chaykin serving as the Scarlet Speedster's scribe, this was a can't-miss venture. Unfortunately, there are some things that even The Flash can't outrun. Bounced around the schedule by CBS, numerous preemptions, and an animated juggernaut named Bart Simpson did what The Flash's rogues gallery couldn't. They stopped The Flash in his tracks after one magnificently memorable season. But they did not stop John Wesley Shipp, who went on to appear in NYPD Blue, Sisters, Dawson's Creek, Teen Wolf the series, and in 2014, producers of the new version of The Flash time-traveled back to 1990 by incorporating many of the elements of the original series. One of the biggest moves was bringing John back into the Flash family for some of the series' most memorable moments. Well, speeding into the lair today is a two-time Emmy Award-winning actor. He is the original fastest man alive from the 1990 CBS show The Flash. These days, he's back in the world of the Scarlet Speedster as Henry Allen on the CW smash The Flash as well. He is John Wesley Shipp. John, welcome to Comic Book Central.
Thank you. Good to be here.
Good to have you here, and good to meet up with you at Terrificon just a few weeks back. That was I really enjoyed that Q&A that we had.
I did, too. That was amazing reception.
Great crowd.
Yeah, the crowds have been, of course, you know, with the advent of the new show, now there's even renewed interest in the original show. You know, now that the CW seed has pulled and is streaming all the episodes there, and the reaction when I've done personal appearances has been more than I could have hoped.
Yeah, it's amazing. And you're everywhere these days. I mean, have you taken a tally of how many miles you've logged since the current Flash? How many comic conventions you've done? You've been everywhere.
I feel like I'm running for office. Yeah, it's been, you know what, I feel like I have the time to do it. I remember when I was playing Barry Allen, of course, I was there 55 to 80 hours a week, and now Grant has that workload on his shoulders, and I have time. I sort of dip in and out and have some terrific stuff to do. I love playing Henry Allen, even as a standalone character. I think the fact that I was Barry helps me play Henry and also informs the relationship between me and Grant. But I do have the time, and so I like to get out and press the flesh, as they say, whenever I can have that personal connection.
What's the reaction you're getting? Because I mean, obviously my listeners have, when they're hearing this interview, they've heard the Q&A, we played that for them, so they hear that. But what's the reaction you're getting, just even from people in general coming up to you and seeing you back in this world again, and this world that we know and love?
It's excitement. You know, I get an enormous sense of people who've been comic book fans for a long time when it wasn't cool, you know. And the first Flash show, we came in right at the beginning of it starting to be cool again. But, you know, there weren't 180,000 people at San Diego Comic-Con then, you know. Not even close. I walked through in a few hours and signed a handful of autographs, and then it was back to L.A., you know. So I think there's a sense of vindication, you know, kind of like, we were right, and, you know, now their love has exploded mainstream. And what a time to be a comic book fan. These things going on and overlapping and intersecting, and there's the Marvel guys and there's the DC guy against the DC guys, you know. It's great. I think it's great.
The superhero crossover team-ups that we all know and love. Yeah, and it's not often you get a second chance to go back and do something. So we'll talk about that. But before we get into the crazy world of superheroes and spandex, let's go back in time a little bit. You're used to time traveling right now, right?
No, absolutely.
You've done a little bit. What kind of kid were you?
What kind of kid was I? I was to myself a lot, although I was a strange kind. I always say I have an extreme extrovert father and an introvert mother, and I sort of bounce back and forth between those poles. I was very much involved in music as a kid. I started studying piano before I was 5 years old. My first piano teacher had to teach me the alphabet so that she could teach me how to play. And then studied concert organ, and then went to Indiana University, actually, on a voice performance scholarship in the opera theater department before switching my major to theater and then dropping out and continuing my studies in New York.
Okay, why go the path of acting then? Because if you're thinking music on one line, what drew you toward the acting part of it?
Well, you know, that's hard to say. It's hard to say. It was, so, you know, I I hate to say this. I've said it before. I said, well, you know, I went into acting because it was easier. Now, nobody in their right mind would ever become an actor. Because, I mean, it's like one of the highest unemployment rates in the world. It's such a cutthroat business to get your foot in the door.
You've waited on a few tables, haven't you?
I have waited on, I moved to New York and waited tables for about 2.5 years,
yeah.
While I was doing showcases for no money and trying to get an agent. And.
So not easy in that respect, but it just musically, you just saw that as more of a more work being put in on the front end.
Well, I had gotten into some vocal habits and that were not being resolved. And so I sort of started spending more time in the theater department, and I got involved with a couple of productions, one of Company by Stephen Sondheim, and then I was in The Crucible, Arthur Miller, and I started gravitating more toward that. Then when I moved to New York, I started studying voice again, and, you know, I've been currently in Oklahoma at the Sullivan Theater in Illinois, and a workshop to musical Philco blues with Judith Ivy at the West Beth. And, you know, I love singing. I sang a lot on Guiding Light.
I was going to say, it didn't stop you from singing on daytime, that's for sure.
That's right. I sang all the time on Guiding Light. I think if I sang You Needed Me one more time on that show, everyone's ears would have started bleeding. But, yeah.
Well,
but I sort of have kept music for me. You know, I've continued to study. My teacher takes off for the summer, and we'll start classes again this fall. They're kind of trying to talk me into doing some more musical stage work, but we'll see. I train classically, and then I act, and that's sort of been the way it's been.
Well, I mean, you've had so many different roles over the years and so many different characters and just depth of all these different performances. Like I said, before we get to the superhero stuff, I do have a question from one of my listeners here on Comic Book Central on one of your non-superhero deeds. Paul Gleave from Perth, Western Australia. He says, I really enjoyed John's turn as a steroid-abusing cop in the first season of NYPD Blue. Just wondered if he had any memories of his time working on that show along with thoughts on David Crusoe and Dennis Franz.
You know, people always say, were you afraid when you got the Flash that you're going to be typecast? And I always say, I think we touched on this in the Q&A, I was lucky very early on in my soap work, being able to go from Guiding Light and breaking type by playing a maniac on As the World Turns and then Santa Barbara. The same thing happened post-Flash. There was this hot new show, NYPD Blue. Everybody wanted that part. I wanted that part. It just so happened I was doing a play at the Tiffany Theater in Los Angeles called The Killing of Michael Malloy, which is based on a true story set in Queens, I believe, or the Bronx, Queens. God, it's been so long. In 1936. So I was dealing with that kind of energy and that kind of speech pattern, and this role came up, and I auditioned for it, and they gave it to me. And I, you know, people, I got a really good reaction from that because, you know, you're only, whatever you did 5 minutes ago is all that you can do in the minds of a lot of people in the business. You know, they have, it's very short in memory. So I just played a superhero, really good guy. They forgot my Emmys for Psychotic. So then I play a drug addicted cop and they go, oh my God, we didn't know you had, you know, it's
this
like
revelation. That,
yeah. When actually I'd been going back and forth between Goodbye for 10 years before I ever got to NYPD Blue.
Yeah, it cracks me up because my wife and I we loved that show, and then we saw you show up on it, and I'm like, oh, it's The Flash. I love this guy. And then it always cracks me up, that scene where David Crusoe takes you out. I'm like, that ain't going to happen. He's a Flash. There's no way that's going to happen.
Did you hear the first line in my first episode about having lost my Flash money?
I didn't pick that up.
It's one of Roy's first...
Oh, I've got to go back and check
that
out now.
They say, how was Vegas? I say, oh, I lost all my Flash money.
Oh, perfect, perfect. Did you bring that in, or is that they wrote that in for
you? No, that was in the script, and they swear that, you know,
coincidental.
At least somebody told me, no, we didn't write that for that reason. We just put that in that Roy is a gambler. It goes along with his impulsive, you know.
I got to go watch that arc again, but yeah, it always cracks me up. I'm like, Ship would take care of Crusoe in 3 seconds. But anyway, you know. All right, let's talk about some superheroes. The Flash, we talked about this in the Q&A, getting that role. Was there anything in your acting background up to that point that could have prepared you to put on a $25,000 rubber suit and be a superhero?
Nothing. Nothing. In fact, I had some concerns about that in 1990. Concerns, by the way, that I don't see any concern on the part of Grant, because it's a quarter of a century later, and comic books have exploded mainstream, and everybody's used to acting in suits, and everybody accepts it. The supernatural is so much a part of our entertainment life. You can hardly turn on a television show without somebody exploding, you know, vaporizing into a mist or exploding into a rocket, you know? So, but back in the day, and I was just coming out to L.A., it was the same thing that kind of made me shy away from musical comedy. Musical comedy being, now I did Side by Side by Sondheim, which is, there's nothing more magical or deeper or richer than that. But a lot of musical comedy is very presentational. And that's not the kind of acting I had trained in, nor was it the kind of acting I wanted to do. And the way comic books had been presented on TV up to that point was fairly presentational. The old Batman series, of which when I was a kid, I was a big fan. I loved it and wouldn't miss it. But that kind of presentational acting was not something that I felt that I would do very well, and it was not where my interest lay. So, you know, to go into a comic book superhero, my first reaction was, well, I don't, you know. And I talked to April Webster, multiple Emmy Award winning casting director, who was casting The Flash, and she said, just read it. She said, just read the script. And she said, you know, if it were what you're describing, do you think I would be attached? So I read it. I saw that there were human motivations. I saw they were taking the relationship seriously. There was humor, but it wasn't camp humor as much as it was, oh, I can't believe it was over so quickly. You know, and then you find out they're watching a boxing match. But, you know, little jokes like they're in bed. Yeah. So I thought, well, yeah, I can play. You know, I said, you know, I've trained in truth at the moment. I really want to crack that nut. She said, well, that's why we're coming to you. And so I saw the relationship with the brother. I saw Barry Allen as an unblessed child in a family where real cops work the streets, who nonetheless has a very close relationship with his older brother, who was killed, and there's a revenge motivation to avenge his death, and that's what leads him, after a chemical accident, to want to assume these powers. And I thought, okay, I can play that side of it, you know. And they didn't ask me to do the role, they asked me to audition, and I auditioned, and there were countless other guys who were auditioning. It was the hottest new show that fall. And they took me and one other person to network, and then they gave it to me, and it was a wild year, let me tell you.
Had you seen Tim Burton's Batman coming into that? Because obviously a lot of similarities to that.
Yeah, they were both, you know, I talked to them about that, Howard Chaykin and those guys. They said, well, you know, all these projects were in development right around the same time. They all reflect a maturing way of telling these stories for adults as well as for kids. I remember Danny telling me, he said, you know, if we have our way, we'll be getting complaints from PTAs all across the country every week. You know, they wanted to make a comic book show for adults.
Yeah.
And so what you saw in Batman was the same sensibility that was propelling forward the original Flash, was no, we're gonna sort of strip all the camp out of it. We'll bring some of the humorous elements back in, but we want to get down to the souls of what has made serialized drama in comic book form last. You know, the Flash was 50 years old when I assumed it. Now, as we know, the Flash character is 75 years old in DC Comics. So what's made that serialized form of drama so appealing for all those years? And to take a new look at it, you know, to give it some darkness and some edge and relatability for a modern audience.
Yeah, I mean, you had the Batman suit, similarities to the Batman suit, I think, and then you, of course, you know, Danny Elfman scoring it. Even the look of the show, you got the sort of the 1940s influence coming in, the gangs, much Howard Chaykin coming in, Danny Bilson, Paul DeMeo, and they were comic book fans themselves.
Yes.
How describe that dynamic of working with them and what they were bringing into it, what Chaykin was bringing into it, just from a comic book perspective and taking that into a darker place.
Well, the main thing, like I said, was everybody wanted to make a really good show, a really serious show. You know, we were nominated for an Emmy for our art direction. You know, I think the deal was 40s and 50s meets 90s, you know. And so the cars, that was the template. And, you know, Danny and Paul really wanted to make an hour movie a week. And they had all the comic book history and knew about the character, none of which I had. I had not read comic books. So they would fill in the blanks for me. Of course, Howard's a maniac. You know, I love Howard. Howard was close to my own heart in that, you know, he wanted to mine the darkness as I did. I wanted to keep it adult. I didn't, you know, some of the silliness I wasn't real comfortable with. And I'll tell you, the biggest confront that I had the whole season was in the last Trickster episode when, you know, Barry is put under the spell of the Trickster. And now we're running around, and I'm smashing parking meters, and I'm catching bullets and throwing it back at the police and being goofy and silly and jumping up and down, you know, totally mind-controlled by the Trickster. And that was a huge confront for me because, you know, I, being in a suit, I wanted to have as little dialogue as possible. If I had had my way, only sections of the suit and blurs would ever have been seen at any one time. And suddenly, you know, in a way it made me confront, in the last episode that we did, my greatest fears about doing a costume character was I'm jumping up and down, being silly and goofy. And, you know, I have to tell you now, you know, we had the 25th anniversary of The Flash at CineFamily at a theater in Los Angeles several months ago, and Mark Hamill was there, and Danny and Paul, and Howard, and
Joyce Heiser,
everybody, you know, Mark, and we got to see those two episodes, and I have to say, some of the most fun that I have now, 25 years later, is watching all the goofy stuff that Mark and I got to
I was
do.
Curious about your perspective 25 years ago on that to today, because it's pretty much a Looney Tunes cartoon come to life.
Yeah.
Down to the music, down to the, you know, Mark's voices and everything. Yeah, it's just unbelievable. So, yeah.
And a lot of that, and, you know, Howard even said at that Q&A, he said, you know, the rest of our episodes were not, you know, that was the lightest.
Yeah.
And a lot of that was built because when Mark came in for that first episode, it was just magic. And they built that second Trickster episode around the wonderful energy and character that he brought to that part. And it drove us into a much lighter, lighthearted, not taking itself maybe quite so seriously template that I think I'm glad we had an opportunity to explore that.
Yeah, they're very cool episodes. Now, as you're going through, obviously, you know, we talked a little bit about this in the Q&A too, was that, you know, the preemptions, the baseball playoffs, the Gulf War, all these crazy things, and you're bumped from it's the Simpsons, you know. It's like you're bumped to 8:30, all these crazy things. So it's tough to just get a slot. As this was going on and all the preemptions, were you getting notes from CBS coming in? Were they saying more comic booky with it? Because there is a definite arc through the series that it goes from the sort of gang, the Howard Chaykin kind of gang, tough, gritty thing toward the more, you know, you got the Mirror Master, you've got Captain Cold, things like that.
Well, you know, whenever you do series television, you know that by the time you get the shooting copy of the script, it has, you know, 30 sets of handprints on it, you know. you know, and everybody, yes, I do feel that that's, a lot of that was going on. We had the filmic contingent from Warner Brothers, and we had CBS. You know, we had initially said the suit would not be seen. Well, the first notes we began getting from CBS was people want to see the suit, you know, and I was, of course, saying, yeah, but once you've seen it, you know, well, of course we want people to want to see it, but it should only be seen really carefully and sparingly. You know, they wanted... particularly as we begin to struggle. You know, we debuted to strong numbers before, as you alluded to, they started preempting us and moving our night. And nothing is more frustrating than working as hard as we were working. And then, oh, my God, we're not on. Oh, my God, we're not on next week.
Yeah,
oh
I couldn't
God,
find it. I couldn't find
it. You know,
it
when hardcore comic book fans can't find you, you know it's just a matter of time. But And, you know, we didn't have DVRs then. I mean, you couldn't just... find it, record it, set it to search and record, and then watch it whenever you were ready.
No, my VCR was smoking by the time I was done. I was trying to find you guys. Yeah, so I mean, you talk about the suit. Did you keep it? Do you have any of it?
Oh, God, no. First of all, it was disintegrating by about the third or fourth episode. We had to constantly do maintenance.
Oh.
There were challenges with the suit. If it had been a hard construction like the Batman suit, it would have been easier to maintain, but it had to be flexible because the Flash is, you know, as bulky and muscle bound as it was flexible. You know, it would bend. It would, you know, the muscles would breathe. Breathe is the wrong word because it was the hottest thing I've ever had to endure.
I read some things where you're talking about like swimming and in puddles.
Just swimming in puddles. Yeah, just it was unbelievable. And nobody really believed it until I would have it on for 20 minutes and I'd say, just squeeze the arm. And it would ring out like a sponge.
Oh.
And people were like, oh my God. Of course, about being in that for about 30, 45 minutes, I start, you know, listing to the left and glazing over. So they got me a cooling suit like race car drivers, where at least I could plug into an ice chest in between scenes and sort of jolt myself awake, bring my body temperature down some. But
yeah, I noticed there's no like kissing scenes or anything with you in the suit. I don't think Amanda Pays probably wanted to get anywhere near you.
Oh, God, no. But then they couldn't clean them, you know, because it was foam latex and they were crumbling from all the sweating. So they just would hang it up. They would just spray it with Lysol.
You didn't keep anything? Like, because I think
somebody, kept nothing.
Somebody said, like, at the end of the last episode, you, like, flung the wings into the garbage can and Hamill was...
Not into the garbage can. I ripped them off and I threw them in the air. No, I wasn't so disrespectful that I took them off and threw them in a garbage can.
They could find them.
I ripped the ears off in celebration and threw them in the air.
Yeah.
And Mark about lost his mind, climbing over garbage cans and wires and light wires and behind lights, saying, don't let them get away.
Hamill's got them?
I think he's got them.
Yes.
I think he still has them. I wish now, looking back, I've worked with actors who kept pictures, stills from the set, props, costume pieces. The only costume pieces I kept were ones I actually wanted to wear. Like, I still have Barry Allen's raincoat where he goes to the crime scene, the very first crime scene in the pilot, and he's got that Hugo Boss raincoat. I have that Hugo Boss raincoat, baby.
Okay.
I wear it. And in fact, I wore it in the Tricksters episode in the new Flash.
I was going to ask if that was the same jacket.
The same coat, yeah.
Yes. Yeah. Oh, I love that. That's why I was. That was one of my questions I was going to ask you, because it is so iconic when you watch the show. So fantastic. Well, so okay, you didn't keep the suit, but you got the jacket. Hey, you did something very cool during the Q&A, and I'd kind of like to follow that up on this interview. Talk about some of these standout episodes. You kind of did a great job of breaking down Twin Streaks on that. So for listeners, if you haven't heard it, go back and listen to John talk about that one. That's a great breakdown of that. I want to talk about some of these the standout episodes. Obviously, your favorite, I think you've mentioned, is the pilot.
I love the pilot because it was rooted in the human family drama, and we got to meet the Allen family. We got to find out what the family dynamic was. We got to find out what was motivating Barry. And so I like that. And I also, as I said in the Q&A, I enjoyed the psychological deconstruction of this person who has a superhero side of his personality and a human side of his personality, and how those things come into conflict, you know, the conflict between those two sides of one rather ordinary person, so that I enjoyed exploring in Twin Streaks.
We love Paula Marshall. What happened to Iris?
Oh, I love Paula. Everybody loves Paula. But, you know, the way it was more a matter of they went so far, I think, in deciding to make her bohemian, and she's presented as though from another world in that pilot. You know, she's sort of in the house with the Allen family, but she sort of looks like she doesn't quite belong there, the character. You know what I mean?
Yeah, very artsy. And then
they decided they wanted Barry to be free to have, you know, they loved my chemistry with Amanda, whom I adore, and I do Paula, you know. Yeah. But they decided to have, they wanted to explore that route. You know, it's very interesting. I love the young actress on the new show. Candace Patton had said to a friend of mine, she said, you know, because she went back when she got cast and she watched the original Flash, and she had made a very smart comment. She said, you know, one thing John didn't have during the series part, he didn't, which is a real tool in Barry Allen's toolbox in terms of fleshing out, is he didn't have an Iris. And I thought, you know, that was a really smart comment.
Yep.
By making the decision to have Barry be available to date this one and that one and have flirtations on and off with Tina, it really sacrificed what is the character of Iris West is a real tool in Barry Allen's toolbox. You know what I mean?
Yeah, that's a very perceptive comment on her part, too.
I thought, I'm dealing with a smart actor here, you know?
And as we've seen, we're going to see a lot more of Iris even in the new one. Well, maybe a scene with Paula and Candace.
Wouldn't that be fun?
Maybe throw that out there. Maybe she can come back. the great Jason Bernard. Ghost in the Machine and Deadly Nightshade. Please talk about him a little bit, because those episodes, look, I love me some Mark Hamill. Everybody knows that. I got to default to Trickster, but man, these episodes are fantastic.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, they resonate. You know, everybody resonates with the father-son template in whatever form it's presented. I think that's why the Henry Allen, Barry Allen relationship resonates in the new show, and I think it's why the Jason's and my relationship resonated in the Nightshade episode, because basically, you know, what you have is this older, you know, hero really, and Barry, you know, is sort of a mentoring relationship there. And I just loved playing off of him. He was, talk about somebody who was just totally grounded and so affectionate in his work. That's a word that really comes to mind. I felt very close to him as an actor in the little bit of time we worked together, and I loved that character, and I would like to have had more playing that.
Yeah,
that dynamic.
He just seemed effortless when I watch those. It almost just seems effortless.
Totally effortless. And he grounded me. You know, it's funny because I don't think I've seen every second of every episode. Either that or I had the world's worst memory, you know, because friends will say, let's pop in an episode. And I'll pop one in and I'll say, I have no memory of that ever happening. Well, the Night Shit episodes were one that somebody recently wanted to see. And we popped in. And I'm looking at Jason Bernard and I'm looking at the way I am when I come to him in the cell and the argument that we have, and I think, God, he totally made me better than I was.
That's great. Yeah, you watch those. You just watch the two of you guys in a scene on a loop. There's some really good stuff there. Here's some comic book trivia here. The great Robert Shane. He played Inspector Henderson on Adventures of Superman. I believe this was his last role, was on The Flash.
Yeah.
Boy, just talk a little bit about him and what that was like to just have him on set with that kind of history.
Fantastic. You know that, you know, and I also love, and it's what Andrew and Greg and Jeff and David are all doing so well on the new show. It's like they respect the continuity, and it's what Danny and Paul did on the first show, and Howard. I mean, when you have real comic book fans, people who are fans of the art form, the pop culture art form, then they will do things like that. They'll name streets. You look at the names of the streets. Everything throws to something else. When you have this huge culture to pull from, it makes sense to do inclusions. And it was great to have him there on the set. He was, you know, he was such an affable, such a nice man. I've been in contact with his daughter since then, talking about the time that he was there. He's a legend, and particularly for people who are hardcore comic book fans, when you do something like that, I think it proves two things: that you have a respect for the form, and that you're very confident in what you're currently doing. I often said when they were doing the new Flash, I didn't know if they would throw to the old show or if they would want to unburden themselves with the old show and create their own thing. Either one of those two roads, I would have completely understood. The fact that they've been so enthusiastic about including pieces of the old show lets you know that they are damn confident in what they are doing today, that they can broaden the palette to include from yesterday as well.
Yeah, enthusiastic to say the least. They are really embracing it too. And I think I read somewhere that at the time, Robert Shane, when he was appearing there, he couldn't see very well or at all?
No, he couldn't. No,
and
no,
he couldn't. Like he learned his line, like his wife read them, learned them by memory?
Yes.
Oh.
Yeah, phonetically, yeah.
That's just amazing. That's amazing that he's a part of that too. Murphy and Bellows. guys, come on, give me a break. Vito D'Ambrosio, who he's in the new Flash. We talked about that. He's in the new Flash too. And Biff Maynard. He passed away obviously last year. But Murphy and Bellows, these guys, and the one episode that kind of stuff was Be My Baby. You got the two officers who apparently are the only two officers on the force, I think.
they're the only two officers on the force. Yeah, Central City is not that big.
There's got to be. So they're in drag in this episode.
I know.
There has to be a story there. Was there anything you could tell us about these two guys that are really standouts on the show?
Well, obviously, you know, I mean, the cops began to have a lot. Murphy and Bellows began to have a life of their own, both because Vito is very grounded in the real work. You know, he's grounded. He's like, you know, he's truth of the moment, grounded in the work. And you just never knew on the other end of the spectrum what Biff was going to come out with. So the tension between these two very different performers, you know, in this partnership, is what's so funny, because you get to see Vito working one way and you get to see Biff in a totally other universe and sort of the comic tension between those two. I don't specifically remember being on set when they were in drag, but I can only imagine.
They're trying to trap. Yeah, they're trying to trap the guy coming in with the baby, and so they, for some reason, instead of getting female officers, they just put those two in drag. He's got the mustache, hey, man. It's just crazy. But yeah, watching these two work, and you get to work David Cassidy,
yes,
as the Mirror Master, and boy, is that in. Even in this episode, too, you get to play Professor Zoom. Kind of.
Yeah, kind of.
There's like
I don't know what possessed me to do that characterization. Somebody just edited those moments out and sent it to me on Facebook, and I'm watching it, and I'm looking at the hair, and I'm looking at the glasses, and I'm listening to the accent, and I'm like, Tom, were you on acid?
Was that one at the end of your 80-hour work weeks or something?
That was toward the end. That was like at 4 o'clock in the morning, you know.
How many bottles of hair gel?
That's Lana Sharp. She created the trickster hair, and she did the Zoom hair.
What was the great Keith Partridge like to work with?
Well, he was fine. He was great. You know, I mean, we were really blessed with guest stars who really wanted to be there, you know, and who knew more about the comic book medium than I did. But it was pretty much uniform that by about the third day of shooting, you know, you'd always see like guest stars hit the wall, except for Mark. And Mark just completely dynamited the wall. There was no wall. But everybody else, they get to a point where they'd hit a wall, like you just see it written on their face. We just don't know if we're going to make it through the rest of the episode. You know?
Yeah.
And how many actors came to me and said, you mean you do this every week? I said, oh, yes. From the third week in August to the second week in May, with 4 days off for Christmas, and that was it. Oh. But
all the effects and the pyrotechnics. I mean, because there's something blowing up in every episode.
Danny. Danny wanted to blow it up. Excuse me. He wanted to blow stuff up.
He did it too. He blew up something every episode. And there's your poor stuntman. Like, he's just being fun. We talked a little bit about the you know, it's a great story you tell in the Q&A too. About how real things got for your stuntman as well too.
Oh, yeah.
But all the effects. I mean, even with David Cassidy, you've got like the multiple versions of him. So yeah, that's got to be time consuming.
Well, for instance, you take something like, you know, and it goes by in a couple seconds where he does the effect, and I'm being zoomed, and he like, and I go, snakes, you know, and it. I'm covered in snakes. Well, they didn't CGI those snakes in. They had snake wranglers with two bags of snakes, like big, long garbage bags.
You're covered in them? You are?
As I stood there, they lifted the snakes one by one and put them on me. At one point, a snake was climbing over my head, getting in between my nose and my glasses and pushing my sunglasses off, and I could see the tongue. You know, another one was crawling around. I mean, they had about five or six snakes. That poor Lana, we talked about Lana, the hairdresser, she about fainted. Danny Bilson is afraid of snakes. He had to leave the set.
Whoa.
When they were doing that, I said, yeah, you coward.
How long were you with snakes on? Like, how long of the day? How much of the day was that?
I think it must have been 6 months.
That was the entire run of the series.
Snakes. I was there.
Oh,
no,
wow.
It wasn't that long. I mean, basically, to get that shot probably took 25, 30 minutes. Oh, but I know Danny left the set when they started putting the snakes on you. I'm like, great.
Oh, that's crazy. That's crazy. Yeah, you know you're in trouble then. You know things are getting real. I mean, but the look of the series, when you talk about this overall, the look is amazing. Just unfortunate timing with all the, you know, that time period. But look, we mentioned Professor Zoom. I've got it before we talk about New Flash, the Batman, the Brave and the Bold.
Yeah.
So you pretended you were Professor Zoom on the old series, the 1990 series. You are Professor Zoom. This is what threw me off, though, because when you were in the New Flash, I thought, are they making him Professor Zoom? What are they doing here? You know, because what was it like coming back to that world to voice Professor Zoom for the animated series?
Oh, it was fun. I was down visiting my brother and my little nephew, Benjamin Wesley Shipp, who's like ranked in his age category in golf. He plays tournaments all over Edinburgh and all over the country and all the famous golf courses. And but anyway, he was playing a tournament down in San Diego. And so I was down in San Diego, and I got this call from Warner Brothers asking me if I would voice Professor Zoom in a Flash-centered episode. And so I said, yeah, sure. Well, you know, when you go in, it's Dietrich Bader, Batman, of course, and we're all standing in a semicircle, but we have no visuals, and you can't turn and act with the other actors. You have to stay on mic. I was constantly wanting to turn and do my scenes with the, they go, cut, John, could you stay on mic, please? And I had nothing visual to work off with, so actually my characterization was pretty flat to begin with. Well, they took that and they animated it, and then they brought us back in to replace bits of dialogue in which there was a technical problem or they wanted to do a different take. And but now you're watching the character, you're watching the animation. Okay. And suddenly my character came to life, and a couple of lines that I had to redo, it was a different character. And so at the end they were like, John, how do you feel about staying and redoing your entire part? I said, yeah, I love it. Now I know what I'm doing. Now I have something visually to cue off of. But that's, I have all the respect in the world for voice actors, how they can stand right on that mic and it's all exploding in their head. And, yeah, you know, I'm now doing a radio western, Powder Burns, that David Gregory, who played one of my sons in One Life to Live in 2010-2012, has written and produced. We had Robert Vaughn come in to our last episode. It's all available on iTunes. And it's
like
it's,
a radio,
you know,
play?
They're like 20-minute episodes, westerns, and it's called Powder Burns. We have a Facebook page and Twitter pages. You can go to powderburnswest.com. And you can find the episodes,
oh,
or
fantastic.
Like I say, they're all streaming on iTunes. And but it's amazing to remind yourself, you know, you can be moving your hand. It doesn't care. You can have the best facial expressions in the world. Angle matter. You know, you
yeah.
sort of have to tie your arms to your side and just funnel whatever is happening through your voice, because that's the end of the day. And what amazed me about Robert Vaughn was, you know, there's some actors and they come in and it appears like they're doing, talk about effortless, that they're doing nothing. And then when you hear it, it's so much more than you remember seeing happening. And it's just a magic that some people have.
Oh, we're going to have to check that. I love radio. There's such a move toward that now, especially with podcasts and everything. There's a lot of these radio dramas and things. You know, we've actually done some on the Indiana Jones podcast. So, yeah, very cool stuff. So looking forward to that, too. Talk about getting second chances. You got one at Professor Zoom. You got a second chance at the Flash universe playing Henry yeah. Allen. Much different version than M. Emmett Walsh's version of Henry Allen.
Yes.
you're a little lighter, I think, than M. Emmett was. But I want to talk about a couple of these episodes. Crazy for You, standout episode definitely of the season. My wife and I, we're going back and rewatching these. Because you get to the finale and you're like, oh, whoa, all that happened. So now we're going back and trying to figure out what we missed, the little things we go in. And my wife just turned to me after the scene of you and Grant in the hospital. Mm-hmm. And she just turned to me and she said, I love that. Best part of the series so far.
Mm-hmm.
That, I mean, and it's a great series. What, just talk a little bit about the dynamic between you and Grant Gustin and how you both get to those places. Because they're amazing.
It's been an absolute joy to work with them. I think you got a couple of things happening. You've got a fine young man, a fine young actor. Everybody is crazy about him. He's that type of person. He's insanely talented at the dawn of his career. And he's assuming this role. He knows that I was the Flash. I know what he's going through. So just in our first meeting, there was already a dynamic built in that since we both try, you know, to work from a sense of truth in relationships and acting, that we were able to funnel what just was going on between me and Grant, right, and put it right into the service of Henry and Barry. It's also the genius of casting and producing. I think what a wonderful idea. So much of your homework, you know, when you're playing a father and a son character, you go back and you recreate and you reinvent the relationship. What is a father-son dynamic relationship like? What is this father-son dynamic relationship like? And you go back and you say, in what ways, when I was young, was I like this character that is now my son? Well, I was in his skin. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. I was running around in a suit being a version of that character. So we had a lot of our homework done for us, you know. And you know what I like to say? I remember one story that sort of really says it. I remember once we came on, and of course, you know, Grant had the emotional heavy lifting to do in this scene, and he was like, you know, I'm so tired. I just don't know if it's going to be there for today, you know. And I said, well, you know, let's just don't worry about it. Don't worry about the obligation, emotional obligation. Let's just show up and talk to each other. And that's something gets triggered. And I think it has something to do with the fact that I played that character before. Mm-hmm. And I am so happy. And at the beginning, particularly, had so many hopes and dreams that were left unfulfilled when I did The Flash that I was hoping that would be fulfilled for him. Well, that's already kind of a paternal thing going on, you know, and we just funneled it right into the very fine writing and the very wonderful. The thing I love about playing Henry Allen in this is that, you know, when everything starts to fall apart and he needs to go, talk about being a tool in Barry Allen's toolbox. I think in this version, Henry Allen is a very important tool for Barry. Is that when Barry wants to let it all go, when he needs to get vulnerable, when he needs to let it all crumble and go, he goes to his dad. And so we have these beautiful moments where in the midst of this action and just unbelievable special effects and wonderful storytelling, just burning up the story as fast as they can at a wicked pace. There comes a point when everything stops and Barry goes to his dad. And something magic happens. And part of it is they found so many different ways to write that scene. Yeah. You know, there's me being defeated. There's him telling me he's going to find it. There's him coming and telling me that now he lost an opportunity to get me out, so every day I'm in jail is his fault from here on out. And then there's me wanting to open the door to let him know that I know without busting or pulling his covers, still giving him the autonomy of deciding when he wants to tell me, but opening the door by saying, well, if the Flash were my son, I'd tell him some things. And then heaping love and approval and affirmation on him so that when he's ready, and he does it in the Trickster episode, he can come to me and take the cowl off and say, yeah, Dad, look what I can do, you know.
What was the mood on the set like after you shot that scene in the hospital? Because you guys plus the writers made us care about those characters so much.
I'll tell you, it's been that way in every scene that we've had together. Mm-hmm. I mean, our first prison scene, we, you know, Andrew was there, Jeff Johns was there, and it was a very emotional scene for both of us, and David Nutter, and they just put their arms around us. They just put their arms around us and just held us, you know, and it's wonderful. It is wonderful when it's like that, you know, when everybody's rooting for you. And then, you know, I would be told, you know, I heard a couple of editors saying, you know, when we were editing this scene, we had to, you know, we were tearing up. Or there's Ralph who directed the Man in the Yellow Suit, also the Trickster episodes. Oh. And you know, we get done with a scene. He says, well, man, you guys can turn a scene out. Or somebody from the crew will come and say, you know, you guys, it's like, and they'll tell me a story about their father. their relationship with their father. So that's what it's like. You know,
that's amazing.
I remember once I wrote the producers after being amazed by an episode. And I said, you know, I hope everyone realizes, particularly the young ones, what a fortunate situation we're in, that shows like this, producers like this, writers like this, special effects like this, the whole combination, actors like this, it doesn't come together in quite this way all the time. It's a very special experience.
It's special for us as viewers, too, to be able to watch this. Another listener question from Jeremy Gunter. Do you think you'll have any scenes with Amanda Pays this season?
I don't know. That brings up a bit of an... that would be problematic, wouldn't it? Because she's playing the same character, and I'm playing a different character. And I'll never forget what Andrew Kreisberg said at Comic-Con when they were saying, and it's been frightening me, Joe, how many people are calling for me to get in a suit again. You know, they want to see the overlap.
Can I add my name to the list?
Andrew Kreisberg made a very good point. He said, how meta do you get before the whole thing falls apart? You know,
yeah.
I mean, when you see me there, I mean, we stretched it with Mark and me because he's playing the same character.
Yeah.
I'm playing a new character. Amanda's, you know, I think it could be, if it were carefully done, and knowing these guys, they wouldn't do it unless it was carefully done. I'd love to work with Amanda again. I think it'd be a trip, but I wouldn't want it to be a stunt. You know, that's like when they said, "Do you want to be a part of the new Flash?" People were saying before I was ever approached. I was like, if I can be included in a way that serves the piece. In other words, not just trotted through in the cameo that would take you out of the story. And that's what I love about the fact that I'm Henry Allen. And that's what I said before. The fact that I was the Flash informs the father-son relationship, and that is what gives it its validity. Not that I played the Flash before, but the fact that I did play the Flash makes me play Henry Allen better.
Completely fair answer to all of that. I appreciate that. I'm not going to ask you to answer any specific questions about season two. I know you can't. But what question would you like to have answered for season two?
I want to know more about Henry. I want to know. I would love to explore. I think it's very curious that Henry never asks any questions. That he hears about the man in the yellow suit and he says, "Drop it." Well, he doesn't even go, "Man in a yellow, what do you mean? A yellow suit? What kind of suit? What are you talking about?" You know, nothing.
Yeah, like a leisure suit? Like a, yeah, right.
Leisure suit. Yellow plaid? What? And, you know, he just says, "Drop it." And then when Barry can go back and change the timeline, it's like, you can't. You know, there's a wonderful scene. There's a real shift in that scene, and it's in the writing, and we played it. Up to that moment, we're going along. I'm saying, "Well, what does Joe think? Well, what is it?" And then he says, "I can do it." And I go, "No, you can't." Well, I would be curious to open that psychology up and find out. Of course, as an actor, I love complexity, so I would love to find out that there's more to Henry Allen than meets the eye. And they're certainly exploring that in the comic books off the hook, you know, and I'd love it as an actor. Now, whether that would serve it all comes back to whether that would serve the piece. You know, I might love to do that as an actor, but it might not be the direction that the show's going in at all. My job is to serve the piece. So, but we'll see. Since you asked, I'd love to see some complexity and some more sides to Henry.
I think you're onto something. I think we would, too. You've done some directing in the past, Whitaker Bay, Palmetto Point.
You know, I was basically brought in to those pieces to not so much direct as to work with igniting an organic process in some very young actors.
Okay.
And I didn't get final cut or final edit or anything. In fact, Whitaker Bay just turned out sort of to be a mess. And if I could, I would take my name off of that.
I saw directing credits on IMDb, and so I had to. Well, you got an organic process in young actors on The Flash, Any chance we're going to see you direct an episode?
Arrow
or Legends?
You know, they're so big. That's the thing with these shows. I'll tell you where...
Would you like to?
Well, I don't know with all the special effects. They're such complicated episodes. I enjoy working with actors. I particularly enjoy working with young actors and sort of inciting little explosions, creative explosions that happen when you sort of insert something into someone's psychology. Maybe they hadn't thought of the character in that way but in terms of, you know, The Flash, it's so enormous. I mean, you know, David Nutter, John Wesley Shipp. I think I'd go with David Nutter.
And you got a pretty sweet gig, too, being able to,
you know,
to come
I mean?
In like you do.
That doesn't mean I would never want to do some directing, but it would be on a show like, you know, if I had wanted to direct like second or third season of Dawson's Creek,
yeah,
that would have been the time to do it, when it was a well-oiled machine, not a special effects show. It was rooted in the drama.
Just curious. We saw that.
It's a good question.
Yeah, you mentioned the 25th anniversary of your original show, the 75th anniversary of The Flash. There's so many anniversaries. There's a hit. We got the current hit show, the movie coming out. Why do you think this character has lasted so long and resonates with so many people?
I don't know. There's the obvious answers, which is the everyman aspect. You know, I think what's fascinating about superheroes is we all want to imagine, particularly as life gets more complex and complicated, and we seem, it just seems like we're in an information age where we have information and disinformation. You don't know what to believe. You don't know which end is up. You don't know how to have an effect or to enforce a change. And all of that finds release in a superhero story, where suddenly you can explode into a speed force or whatever it is, and you can actually have an effect on the world around you in a way that you can't in your ordinary life. And so when you add to that Barry, I think of all of the superheroes, is kind of a doofus. You know, I mean, he kind of stumbles over his own foot, although he's very brilliant. But he is the quintessential nerd.
Yeah.
Who's the crime lab guy who suddenly has this ability to literally run rings around everybody and everything else. And so it really puts the viewer, the comic book fan, you know, I used to say that my job was playing Barry Allen, and my job was to emotionally hook the viewers into Barry Allen so that when I went into the suit, they went with me. And then all the special effects and all the speed force effects was us looking from inside the suit out. And I think Barry allows for that because he's such a relatable guy, you know, that it's easy to hook on to him. And particularly the way Grant plays him, it's so damn sincere. You know, there's no acting, you know, and so likable and real that it's easy to hook on. It's easy to hook on to him.
It's easy for us to hook on to the show and to you and the entire cast. How can fans find out more about you? Facebook, Twitter? Where's John Wesley?
Yeah, Facebook, Twitter. I'm always yapping away, you know. I'm very vocal. I got it honest from my from my family, very activist family, and I'm there. It's the private page on Facebook, not the fan page. I didn't put that up, and I keep it a private page. Although people can follow and we can still dialogue, even though you're not one of the faithful 5,000, which is all they will allow on a private page.
Faithful 5,000. well, we can follow you on Twitter. You're out there tweeting.
Twitter. John Wesley Shipp. Yes, that's me. That's
Flash me. 1990. All episodes are streaming at cwc.com. Flash Season 1 on Blu-ray and DVD. We can get caught up. And John Wesley Shipp is in the Season 2 premiere. You were there October 6th, aren't you, on the CW?
Yes, I am there.
First 15 minutes going to blow our mind?
Yes.
What should we look for?
Without a question.
What should we look for? Give us one thing to look for in that first few minutes.
I can't. I don't dare. I don't dare.
That's fair enough. We are looking for John Wesley Shipp. John, we're having a blast revisiting the original Flash. I can't wait to see what's in store for Henry Allen in the current Flash universe. Thanks for the Q&A at Terrificon. I loved it. And thanks for joining me on the show today.
Thanks so much, Joe. That was good. Yeah, thank you. Take care, Joe. Bye.
Just finished rewatching Flash Season 1, and I will say this. John said something in our Q&A a few weeks ago on the show. If you haven't heard that, by the way, please go check it out. Great stuff. But what he said was that Grant Gustin should have been nominated for an Emmy, and I absolutely agree, especially rewatching the series again, and you get to watch all those amazing moments. You watch the finale, you see that final scene between Grant Gustin as Barry with his mom. Absolutely should have been nominated for an Emmy. And John Wesley Shipp knows a thing or two about Emmy Awards, so he should know. Tough for comic book and genre shows to get that recognition, but you know, who knows? Maybe since half the shows on TV now are comic book shows, the Emmy voters are going to have to take notice. One would hope. But judge for yourself. Check out John, Grant, and the rest of the cast in Season 1 of The Flash. It's now on DVD, Blu-ray, and Netflix. That's, depending on when you're listening to it, that may be a day or two away. Season 2 premieres this week, October 6th. I can't wait. And John in that suit as the original Flash. CW Seed is streaming those episodes free online, as we mentioned. The episodes with Mark Hamill, those are a fanboy's dream. Go check them out. You can follow John on Twitter and Facebook. And do not forget to check out Powder Burns. That's the Western radio drama we talked about. I'm going to put all of the links to everything you heard about today in the show notes at my website, comicbookcentral.net. Again, my thanks to John for the Q&A at Terrificon. A true highlight. He is a gentleman. He is an amazing guy. So friendly. And I thank him for joining me today. And also for being our original Barry Allen. Love that show. Hey, not only are you going to get all the links we mentioned, but each and every episode of Comic Book Central, they're on the website. ComicBookCentral.net. Folks, subscribe to the show in iTunes. And if you're in iTunes, please leave a review. If you have the podcast app, it's real easy to do that. That's one way you can show your support for the show. You can also listen on Stitcher, Blueberry. Like the show on Facebook. We're putting some really cool stuff out there, some video clips, some pictures, some cool different things out there. Comic Book Central Network is on Facebook, Twitter at ComicBookCTRL, hashtag share the lair, and I want to hear from you. Joe at ComicBookCentral.net, the Signal Me tab on the website. Let me know your favorite moment from year two. You might just snag that very cool Empire Strikes Back book. All right, kids, time to speed on out of here, but I will be back in a flash because next week on Comic Book Central, the countdown to October 21st begins. That is the day Marty and Doc flew the DeLorean back to the future into our very year. Nope, we don't have flying cars, no hoverboards, no Jaws 19 yet, but we do have one of the masterminds who created the entire Back to the Future universe 30 years ago. I cannot think of a better way to kick off my 30th anniversary celebration of Back to the Future than with an in-depth conversation with Bob Gale. He's going to be here next week. I hope you're going to be here as well. Until then, may the Speed Force be with you. Keep reading those comics. Thanks for joining me here in the lair, Comic Book Central, where comic books come to life. This podcast is intended for entertainment and education purposes only. All original content of this podcast is the intellectual property of Comic Book Central and is licensed under Creative Commons Attribution, Non-Commercial, No Derivation, 3.0 imported license. All of the content and names are registered trademarks and copyrights of their respective holders.
So an actual date this time. Good for you. You didn't tell her your dad's in the slammer.
No, I read in a magazine that that's a big turnoff.
Smart. Hey, you see this?
No, I haven't.
The Flash. I saw him once in here. Watched him save Joe's life.
Joe told me about that. I guess he was lucky.
Lucky Joe. Strangest thing, I get roughed up by Julius, end up in here. Next thing I know, Julius's car trying to escape claims the Flash broke him out. Won't be seeing Julius for a long time now. Guess I'm lucky too, huh?
Dad, if I was the Flash, don't you think that you'd be the first to know about it?
Well, if the Flash were my son, I'd tell him a few things. First off, I'd tell him it's a dangerous world, so be careful. Then I'd tell him he's a hero. And he's saving a lot of lives. But the most important thing for him to know, I feel, is that his father's proud of him.